to a new episode of Light the Lamp. I'm Alexis Downey. We're in the busy stretch of the NHL season here in March, and the trade deadline is in the rearview mirror now. So who better to have on this week than TSN insider and senior columnist for The Athletic, Pierre LeBrun. Pierre, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a bit.
Yes, it's been a while, Alexis, but thanks for having me back on. And since the last time I've been on last year, a lot has changed with your Anaheim Ducks. So we got lots to talk about here.
Yeah, it's been a crazy year, but all good things for the most part. And so let's just kind of jump into your perspective, you know, of this season. It's been a condensed year for the NHL, kind of crazy schedule, of course, with the Olympics and everything. What have your just overarching thoughts been on the way the year's gone?
Yeah, well, as someone that was in Milan covering the men's hockey tournament and then landing back in North America and falling right into trade deadline season, I woke up last Saturday, the day after the deadline, and I think I slept about 13 hours. it's been a crazy 4 or 5 weeks. And, you know, the hockey was incredible in Milan, really some memorable moments. And then, just a short runway to a deadline. And I love it. I love it that way. I think next year when we go back to a normal non-Olympic year, non-World Cup year, I think that there's trade deadline fatigue because you end up talking about the same names for 4 or 5, 6 weeks. And I find that people start to get trade deadline fatigue, quite honestly, or maybe I do. But that's what was so nice is focusing on the Olympic tournament and then having like a 10-day runway to the trade deadline. I love the balance of that. And we'll get that again in 2 years with the NHL and NHLPA hosting the World Cup of Hockey in February. Best on best. I wonder how much tension there'll be in that U.S.-Canada rematch in the round robin where fighting is allowed. We'll see how that goes.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting. From your perspective of the Olympics, was that your first one or had you covered other Olympics?
That was my sixth Olympics. Wow. I'm dating myself, Alexis. I'm an old guy. I covered the Sydney Olympics when I was a young Cub sports reporter for the Canadian Press National News Agency in 2000. I did a bit of everything in those days. But after that, it was all hockey, all Winter Olympics, starting with Salt Lake in 2002. And then, of course, Torino, Vancouver, Sochi, and then Milan. So whenever the NHL players have been there since 2002, I've been at the Winter Olympics, and it's the best hockey alive. There's nothing like it.
How did this one compare, even the location?
Well, Milan was unreal. I just wish I had more open nights. Those 9 p.m., the third game of the night for most of the tournament, 9 p.m. puck drop was a bit of a mood kill. I'm just kidding. It's amazing hockey to cover, but it didn't allow a lot of free time in Milan. But, you know, Italy's amazing. I felt the same way in Torino 20 years ago. That was sensational. And guess what? The Winter Olympics are in Nice, southern France, in 4 years. Bend my arm. I think I'll try and make time to go in southern France for the next Winter Olympics.
Yeah, I mean, what better place to go to, of course.
It's unreal they're having a Winter Olympics there, but yeah. No one's complaining.
Well, at least there's some mountains nearby. They'll figure out, I'm sure, how everything will run. And got some time until then. Some other exciting things, of course, coming up, like you mentioned. But when you got back with the trade deadline, is there anything that you like to do that gets you ready for the deadline? Mental preparation, anything in particular?
Listen, I honestly check in with all 32 teams in the first couple of days back.
Okay.
And then check in with all the prominent agents who have players that I think could be affected by the deadline. So there's a real 72-hour period where I'm constantly on the phone, and then I stay on a lot of those people from there on out. And you know, there's only so much you can control in terms of the news flow, but I'm not surprised that it wasn't a crazy busy deadline. I had written on the Monday for The Athletic of deadline week. I'd written a piece on Monday, and you know, it's the kind of thing a lot of the hockey fans don't want to read about, but you know, the CBA changes would greatly affect the deadline and turn out to be right. The elimination of the double salary retention, like not involving a third team broker to bring down the cap number of a player, and the playoff cap. You know, we got our first ever playoff cap in the history of the cap era. And that hampered things too for teams that could have simply, you know, used an injured player's salary on a new player. You can't do that if you think that player is coming back in the playoffs. So those two CBA changes had a pretty drastic effect on the deadline. I think, though, what you'll see moving forward is teams being better prepared for that. It's not that they didn't know it was coming, but with a lot more time ahead of next year's deadline, I think teams are going to be able to plan better around that. Not to mention the fact that the salary cap is skyrocketing up again on July 1st. And that'll give teams more, you know, room to maneuver as well.
I'm glad you mentioned this summer, because I saw you also wrote an article about how this summer is probably not going to disappoint on that end with all the free agents and everything. So I guess kind of give some insight, you know, for our listeners on, you know, what you're expecting this summer.
Yeah, I wrote the piece because I could sense that hockey fans were disappointed in the deadline, although not in Anaheim with the acquisition of John Carlson. We can get that get to that in a moment.
Yeah.
But in general, hockey fans felt it was more of a deadline than a deadline. And I think they're right. I wrote that piece for that reason, that I thought it was timely to you know, illustrate that this offseason could be fireworks. And I started with names that were more likely to move. And as my list of names went on, it went more and more unlikely. But I had some pretty big names on there to end it, because I just want to file it away in case there are some crazy things that happen. And and so the last name in that column is Connor McDavid. Do I think Connor McDavid is going anywhere this offseason? No. But, you know, if you peel back his two-year extension, which he signed right before the season, you know, I don't think there's a world in which Connor McDavid wants to play through that extension and then walk out the door as a UFA in the summer of 28. I believe, and I was told, that he wants to make sure that if he ever leaves, that the Oilers get something in return in a trade. So the natural inflection point is the summer of 27 for Connor McDavid, a year out, where he says, okay, how are we doing? Are we still a contender? All right, maybe I'll sign another extension. Or maybe it's time to talk about a trade out of town. And, you know, the reason I had his name, though, on this story is that what if they get absolutely rocked in the first round by Anaheim or someone else in four straight? Emotion is a strong thing. And that's a guy that all he cares about is winning. And if he suddenly felt like he doesn't see a place in which he can win, all bets are off. Is it likely? No. I think that at the very least, Connor McDavid is with the Oilers at least for another season, if not more. But that was the point of the article. Now, there's some guys that I think are out the door. Simon Nemec, the second overall pick in the 22 draft, the Devils were listening on him hard at this deadline. They didn't end up moving him. But they have a glut at D, and they need help up front. And the real thing here is that he's an RFA coming out at entry level this summer. And I think that his agents already intimated or hinted at the Devils that that Luke Hughes contract looks pretty good as a comparable. So there could be issues there. And I think Nemec will be back in play come the offseason. And boy, there would be a lot of teams lining up for him.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what ends up happening. Of course, having the factor of what happens in the playoffs too, like you mentioned, and you touched on it just a little bit ago, the Ducks acquiring John Carlson. How much of a surprise for you was that?
Yeah, I can't say I'm completely shocked that he was dealt. I'm not sure that I saw Anaheim coming as a team getting him, but there were some red flags. I had put out a little teaser on Carlson again on the Monday, only because he had not been extended by then. And so I know that that had been unsettling for Carlson and for his agent behind the scenes. But I still thought to myself, are they really going to trade John Carlson? So I couldn't bring myself to believe it 5 days out. And it ends up happening. And part of why it happened is the Capitals kept losing games. And it's funny, it's a long season, a lot of games, but those last few games for the deadline end up really impacting decision makers. And it impacted Washington. They went from thinking of extending him to trading a legacy player who had played his whole career in Washington. And I know it was deeply upsetting for John Carlson. He didn't find out about the trade, as you know, until the next morning.
Yeah.
He couldn't get a hold of him, and the trade happened so late on the Thursday night, Eastern time. But, you know, I think he's going to love Anaheim, and, you know, my sense of things, and I wrote this in my rumblings yesterday, but, you know, the Ducks are going to do all they can to extend him. But they're waiting for a bit to let him, you know, get a sense of his new surroundings and let the dust settle. His family's going to come out soon, I'm told. And, you know, I would say about a week out from the playoffs would be a nice little window for the Ducks and his camp to get together and see how they all feel. So either I could see an extension potentially getting done right before the playoffs, or you wait until the playoffs are over and you still have lots of time for July 1st. But I could see something getting done. I think that, you know, once John Carlson gets used to his surroundings, I think he'll be pretty excited about what he sees around him in that locker room as far as a Ducks team that has a chance to win.
Yeah, we're looking forward to seeing his debut, hopefully Saturday or Sunday this weekend. I know that that's been the plan for the team. So looking forward to seeing how he kind of fits in with this group. But Pierre, let's take a look a little bit further into the Ducks, and then we'll go into a little bit more about around the league. But for you this season, seeing the, you know, emergence of Beckett Seneca and the emergence of the Ducks in the Pacific, did you think that they would take this step this soon?
I thought they would challenge for a playoff spot this year. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I thought they'd be challenging for first place in the Pacific, but with all due respect, the Pacific has kind of taken a step backwards this year overall as a division. We're used to seeing Vegas and Edmonton having stronger regular seasons, and both of those normal juggernaut teams have stumbled a bit, which has opened the door for the likes of Anaheim. But, you know, Anaheim reminds me a lot, and it's good timing. They remind me a lot, the Ducks, of the path that the Montreal Canadiens are on with their young team. And they played each other last Friday and they play again this weekend. But, you know, those are two of the youngest teams in the league that, you know, last year Montreal made the playoffs. So that was a giant step for them. The Ducks are going to make the playoffs this year. You know, this isn't about this year or even next year. I think the Ducks and the Habs are positioned to have a decade long window here of taking swings at it, the way they're set up with their core guys. The difference so far, I'd say, is that, you know, Montreal has pretty much its entire core of young guys signed. You know, Lane Hudson being the latest in the fall to sign after a contentious negotiation, but that's the next step for Pat Verbeek. Some of the guys are signed, we know that, but there's some big ones on the horizon here for Anaheim as well. And so once that's done, I'll feel even better about the fact that I look at this Anaheim core and I see a team that's going to take a lot of swings out of here over the next several years.
What a fun game that was last week. I think this week it's going to bring a lot too.
Yeah. And that's a great example of where I wish overtime would just keep going instead of going to a shootout. But,
Shootouts here this year, so
you're okay with it. Well, they're not going to help you in the playoffs.
Right.
And also an example too, at times that I see this in both Anaheim and Montreal's game of the immaturity at times defensively and the structure breaks down but it leads to exciting hockey where you got head coaches pulling their hair out, but there's just so much talent on both those teams. So I'm glad they get to play again this weekend. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. To your point, head coach Joel Quenneville here in his first year back in hockey, you know, seeing him back and just taking the reins on this Ducks team, what has your outside perspective been on that?
Yeah, I kind of wondered how it would play out, especially at his age. I mean, one of the hardest things in the game today is for coaches to be relevant with young players, and you know, today's generation of player is so different. You know, when I broke into covering the NHL 31 years ago, you know, players would routinely on the road go out in a bender and bond that way and have a million beers. And that is just not the way anymore. These young players are so serious, so healthy. A lot of them are vegan. it's a different era. And my point is, I'm going on a bit of a tangent here, but my point is, I think it's impressive that, you know, you're Joel Quenneville and you've been around forever. How do you connect with, you know, a young team? And it helps, you know, one thing Anaheim's done really well, Pat Verbeek, is there are veteran players on that team that, And I think that's really important. You know, you think about trading for Trouba last year and Carlson this year. I love the Rocco Gudas signing a few years ago. Can't mention that in front of Toronto Maple Leafs fans, but but having veteran players be around a young core, I think is critical in the modern NHL. The days of having your entire team be a bunch of young guys and help to grow it are done. Well, they're done for teams that want to win anyway. You know, Detroit's done a good job of that too. Steve Yzerman, where he had veterans from the outset around his young players that were developing with the Red Wings. And you need that because the veterans show the way. They, you know, they teach you the routine and the do's and don'ts. And I could see that influence coming through in Anaheim.
Yeah, it's been an interesting balance in watching how the young players and the veterans have, you know, assimilated in the locker room. And it's it seems like
Alex Killorn being a very important that way.
He's been someone that's taken a lot of the young guys under their wing. And I mean, he's playing with two young guys in Leo Carlson and Cutter Gauthier right now. So, well, him and Chris Kreider, they've kind of all been switching around a little bit this season. But that aside, looking at the Western Conference overall, I mean, we talked about the Pacific and how it's been a bit of a surprise. I mean, the Central Division is so top heavy. It is a couple teams that you don't want to face in the playoffs, certainly. But what do you make of what's happened there?
Well, you know what's interesting? Like, I was thinking today, if you're the Utah Mammoth in the Central, maybe you're okay crossing over to the Pacific as a wild card and avoiding your division for a couple of rounds, maybe, if you can win around, that is. But yeah, I mean, listen, not only are Colorado, Dallas, and Minnesota the top three teams in the West this year, they're arguably the top three teams in the entire NHL. I mean, all due respect to Tampa and Carolina, and certainly there's an argument to be made that Tampa and Carolina and the Buffalo Sabres are in that argument from the East. But I mean, there is certainly, you can defend the argument of Colorado, Dallas, and Minnesota being the best three teams in the NHL. And what's kind of, you know, ridiculous in my opinion, I don't know how controversial I'm allowed to be on your show, but you know, the playoff format stinks, and it has stunk for a long time, and it's wrong. Last year I covered a first round Colorado Dallas series, which was unbelievable. Seven games and the Mikko Rantanen revenge tour and everything that went with it. Gabriel Landeskog's emotional return after 3 years. That was one of the best first round series in a decade. But it's completely unforgivable that one of those two cup contenders went home after the first round. The format is wrong. And I try many times to bring this up with Commissioner Gary Bettman. And in fact, I'm headed to the GM meetings again next week. And when I bring it up, I get yelled at, but I'm not going to give up because I know the players feel this way. I talked to a number of players in Vegas at the start of the year at the player media tour, and the resounding majority of them want to go back to a 1-8, 1-8, 2-7, like it was before this format, which, you know, I just think is it's a fair format. Again, I mean, we're going to get, it looks like Dallas, Minnesota in the first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs. And it doesn't make any sense to me.
Do you know much of the reasoning behind wanting to keep this playoff format that we have right now?
Yeah. So one thing that Bettman has mentioned to me in the past is that a lot of it had to do with, you know, wanting fan bases to have regional matchups so that, you know, in the old, the one thing about the 1-8 is, for example, you could have, like we've had in the past, a Detroit-Anaheim playoff series early on. So where either the fans in Anaheim have to watch a 4 p.m. playoff game from Detroit, or the fans in Detroit have to watch a 10 p.m. game from Anaheim. And so that's one of the reasons that was given to me, is that the divisional slash regional matchups are better for start times. Okay, but guess what? Guess what happens come playoff time, especially for the Central Division teams? You suddenly have a puck drop at 9 o'clock local time in Dallas, like we had last year in Dallas, Colorado, because TV is trying to stagger the start. So I don't even buy that argument. And again, at the end of the day, when the players are telling you they don't like it, and I know some owners and some governors and team presidents don't like it, I think change has to come. And here's where I get it from the league's perspective. You know, when they went to this format, there was a lot of controversy. I don't know if you remember this, Alexis, but they went to this after the 2012-2013 lockout in January, when the lockout ended. This is when they went to this wildcard format as part of realignment. And there was a shocker on a Friday night. I'll never forgetting. I was actually just leaving the TSN studios after doing a show, and I had to do a U-turn and drive back to TSN because the NHLPA had announced that night they had rejected the original realignment playoff format plan that the league had formulated. The original version didn't have this exact version. I think it's the wild cards that weren't set up this way. It was more along the lines of divisional playoffs. So we ended up with what we have, in part because the PA wanted something that was a little more fair to balance out weaker divisions versus stronger divisions, so on and so on. It just doesn't work. You know, I don't know how anyone can argue against going back to 1-8-2-7 as far as it being democratic and fair to teams that have had better seasons.
And also to your point about what we could see again now, back-to-back playoff years where you're having a potential contender go out in the first round. Right. So do you talk about Minnesota? Do you think that they have all the pieces that they need now?
They do. And they could still lose in the first round. I mean, that's what's crazy. This is the best Wild team ever in their history. And the Wild, I'm not including the North Stars, but this is the best Wild team ever. And, you know, Quinn Hughes is an absolute superstar, arguably the best defenseman in the world. Mm-hmm. And has completely changed the makeup of that team. Strong in goal. Amazing blue line. You know, I still think I know Bill Guerin tried, but Vincent Trocheck would have been an amazing fit, but the cost was too prohibitive for Minnesota. So I do wonder down the middle matchup wise, how that fares with Dallas or Colorado, but they could take them down. I mean, hard not to think that Minnesota Dallas won't go seven. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see what happens there. As for the East, Buffalo. I mean, what a story that has been this year.
Unreal.
Did you see that coming?
No. Did anyone see that?
No. I knew that was going to be the answer there.
And in my case, they're just down the highway from me here in Toronto. And I think about 2 years ago, I was like, hey, this is the year the Sabres, you know, make their jump. And when it doesn't happen year after year, you look at the roster every year and you're like, should be there. Mm-hmm. Look at all that talent. And then you start to believe in the idea that the culture of losing and the lack of confidence and the bad habits and whatever. And you know, it doesn't even make sense that as soon as they fire the GM, Kevin Adams, and Jarmo Kekalainen is promoted the GM, that they take off.
Yeah.
Like, it's the same team Kevin Adams left behind.
Yeah.
But for some reason, if you look at the timing of the renaissance of this team, that's when it started happening. And maybe it's just a jolt that everyone needed. But the talent's always been there for a few years now. I mean, really, this should have happened a couple of years ago. Like what you're seeing now with Detroit and Montreal, you know, those teams are not as far along, and like Buffalo, this should have happened 2 years ago.
Yeah.
But it is happening now. And I'm thrilled for the fan base. I mean, Buffalo sports fans are unbelievable and you know, they're for real. But because this will all be new for this team in terms of the playoffs and how the playoffs are different. And I mean, it's hard to know exactly what will happen. What I will say is the East has never been more wide open.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, Carolina's always there and they're running away with the Metro, which is a bit mediocre this year, aside from them. And Tampa's Tampa. Obviously, it's you know, the two-time champs from 20 and 21 that have found a little bit of their throwback magic here. One of the best run teams in the league, front office-wise. But all due respect to that, you could right now, Alexis, tell me why Team X comes out of the East Cup final. I'd say, yep, I can see that. I mean, anyone can beat anyone, I think, personally, in the eight teams that end up making the playoffs in the East.
It's been so close and so different from what the West has looked like this year. It's kind of interesting how that's happened with the league.
Yeah, it's cyclical. I mean, that's basically the bottom line. I mean, the interesting thing about the East this year, I remember writing about this pretty early on because I wanted to be on it before it was obvious. But you have these overlapping programs that we're going to butt heads in the East. Like, you know, let's just look at the Atlantic as an example. Mm-hmm. Florida, Toronto, there forever. But Montreal and Detroit are pushing up, and then Buffalo pushed up. Mm-hmm. Well, they can't all make it.
Right.
So what happens in that division when you have these, you know, teams trying to hang on and teams pushing up? And as it turns out, you know, the two-time cup champion Panthers look frankly just tired and beat up. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you this, they will be right back near the top of the league next season. Mm-hmm. That is an absolute guarantee from me. Mm-hmm. With a healthy Sasha Barkov, their first full off season in 4 years,
yeah,
where their players can actually rest their limbs and take a breather. Florida will be right back, but they're not going to make it this year. Toronto's a little different. I mean, at least they're in trouble. After 9 straight years in the playoffs and trying to find a way, you know, with Austin Matthews and William Nylander and John Tavares, they have a lot of work to do if they want to get back into the playoff mix next year. They need to really thread the needle and have quite an off season in terms of trades and signings. And I'm not totally convinced it's that doable. So that could be the start of a different era for them, but we'll see.
Pierre, as you look down the stretch of the rest of this season, anything in particular that you have your eye on? I know we talked about a lot of different things here, but.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I'm going to knock on my wooden desk.
Okay.
I'm just holding my breath about key injuries because, you know, most teams have 17 games in March and 31 days. Ridiculous. But again, it's the Olympic condensed schedule. Everyone knew they were signing up for it. And so I'm just hoping that, you know, all the playoff bound teams survive and get to the playoffs without losing some key guys. I don't know if it's going to be possible, but that's the biggest thing for me is that in a league that is so close with so much parity, it could come down to a contender or two losing a guy that they don't get back. Mm-hmm. And we sure hope that doesn't happen. But that's something I watch for every night is to make sure everyone, you know, gets away unscathed from that night's game.
So tough with all of these games, as you're saying, as we get down to the end of this season. Pierre, this has been so awesome having you back on. Thank you for taking the time, and we look forward to hopefully maybe seeing you here in the playoffs.
Tell you what, it's been a few years. I used to come out there in the Getzlaf Perry years, of course, and I covered that Kings Ducks playoff series. Mm. I forget what year that was. And one of my highlights
2014.
Of that is that
from my
2014.
Producer. Yes.
And so I stayed at the same hotel in Long Beach and just drove each direction. And it was beautiful. And of course, I went 7 games, a young John Gibson in goal for Anaheim. And the highlight media wise was that one day the Kings tried to one up the Ducks by getting all the media jersey mics. But then the next day, Alex Gilchrist and the Ducks PR came over the top with In and Out. It was a battle between the Kings and the Ducks PR. And you know what? We were the winners, the media that were there covering the series. Yeah. So what can I say?
That's an awesome story. Well, I don't know if we can guarantee In and Out this time, but maybe we can make it happen for you again.
Right. Well, maybe, you know, maybe some red wine. You know, that's I'm never against that.
We can work on that one, too. Thanks again for taking the time.
My pleasure.
This is an Anaheim Ducks original production on DuckStream.